As we've been looking at the Old Testament and the priesthood that's there, it's hard for us to fathom both what was going on and why that was so important. For we don't have anything that even remotely approaches the kind of priesthood and the significance for those people. We don't have that kind of significance on earth for us as Christians today. And yet the high priest in the Old Testament, when he was functioning like he was supposed to, and the priesthood, when it was working like it was supposed to, was at the very heart, center, core of the faith and confidence that Jewish believers had in their relationship with God. Because God had designated the priesthood to be those men who would stand between God and man, who on behalf of devout, seeking believers could offer sacrifices and gifts to God on their behalf. And in turn, God speaking through them, they would teach their fellow man God's law and how to be pleasing to Him. I did find this past week something that's a little unusual. I don't often read out of other publications other than the Bible itself. But in about 200 B.C., 200 years before Jesus, a document has survived down to our day, written by a Jewish believer about the high priest of his day. This high priest was by the name of Simon, and historians designate him as Simon the Second, because there was just a generation or two before him another high priest named Simon. But this would be Simon the Second, and this is found in a document called the Wisdom of Ben Sirah. And it's actually a kind of piece of poetry or a hymn written by Ben Sirah about the high priest. And he's writing in poetic form about being at the temple and watching along with all the other Jewish believers as the high priest goes about his administration, as he on behalf of the people makes a sacrifice for the sins of the people, as he on behalf of himself and then on behalf of the people goes into the most holy place, disappears from their sight behind that curtain and makes the blood sacrifice before the mercy seat of God, and then comes back again to the people. And it really touched me as I read it and realized the depth of feeling that Ben Sirah and others of his day must have had about the high priest and how it assured them of their relationship with God. How splendid he was as he looked forth from the tent, as he came from the house of the veil, like a star shining among the clouds, like the full moon at the holy day season, like the sun shining on the temple of the king, like the rainbow appearing in the cloudy sky, like the blossoms on the branches in springtime, like a lily by running waters, like the greenness of Lebanon in summer, like the blaze of incense at the sacrifice, like a vessel of beaten gold studded with an assortment of precious stones, like a luxuriant olive tree thick with fruit, a plant whose branches run with oil, wearing his splendid robes and vested in sublime magnificence. As he ascended the glorious altar and lent majesty to the court of the sanctuary, when he received the sundered victims from his brother priest, while he stood before the sacrificial hearth, his sons ringed him about like a garland, like young cedars on Lebanon, and like poplars by the brook, they clustered about him. All the sons of Aaron in their dignity, with the offerings to the Lord in their hands, in the presence of the whole assembly of Israel. You see, for them, literally, they stood in an assurance of the forgiveness of their sins and of a right relationship with God based upon what that priest did. And without him, they couldn't have that assurance. The sad thing is that in between the writing of this in 200 B.C. and the coming down to the New Testament period with Jesus and the high priest that served while he was alive, Annas and then Caiaphas, father and then son-in-law. Something changed. The priesthood became a political office. And the priest himself ceased to really be full-blown believers in what they were doing. We sometimes bemoan the fact that our public officials forget who they serve and why they're there. By Jesus' time, that was true of the high priest. It was now a political office. It was an office, actually, literally, that while it stayed in the lineage of Aaron, the high priest was selected by whoever was in charge. First it was Herod, and then later the Roman authorities themselves would have to approve each new high priest as he took his place to replace the old one. And if they were displeased with the high priest, if he seemed to be inciting the people or not carrying out the policies of the Roman government, then they'd replace him with somebody else. And so in the jockeying for position and the desire for power that existed among some who were in the priesthood, they ceased to be concerned as much about the needs of the people and what their role was in that, and more about that position of power and authority that now lay in the hands of the Romans. How hungry then must Jewish people have been to believe in a high priest who had their best interest at heart, who returned to the kind of heart and attitude and service that they could read about in their own ancient scriptures that Aaron had, who would literally, as we read a couple of weeks ago, stand between life and death for the people and beseech God on the people's behalf that God not punish the people for their sins. And so how refreshing it was then, as the gospel began to be preached about Jesus Christ. As we saw last week, the prophecies had been that the coming Messiah was not only going to be king, but also priest, high priest. And yet that was impossible under the law, for the law was very clear. The king came through the tribe of Judah. The priest came through the tribe of Levi, a descendant of Aaron of the tribe of Levi. And yet the prophecies were clear. When the Messiah came, he would be both priest and king. The book of Hebrews lets us in on the secret of how that could be. For it's in Hebrews we find that statement we're building on the top of, how those things of old were a shadow of the good things to come. And at the very center of the book of Hebrews, a book of some, 13 chapters. Let me confirm that. Yes. 13 chapters, from chapter 4 through chapter 8, is a discussion of how Jesus is the high priest that the prophecies were talking about. And so you've got three chapters before it that prepared for that, and the four chapters after that, or five chapters after that, that plays out the implications of it. I was first turned on to some aspects of the book of Hebrews while I was still in college. I wasn't even thinking about being a preacher or spending my life trying to share the good news with other people. I was at Rice University trying to get a degree in physics and electrical engineering, or mathematics, actually, in electrical engineering, when I started hearing a man preach the gospel in the little church where I went, who was excited about the book of Hebrews. And if you just read through the book of Hebrews, there's many things that stand out as unique about it. First of all, the subject matter. For it's helping Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians understand how God was making the transition from the old law and the Old Testament and the old sacrifices and the old priesthood over to the new. And how that was all fulfilled and met its purpose and accomplished its completeness in Christ and in the gospel. But then on top of that is the way the book is constructed. I think most of us realize that when some author uses a word, or some speaker uses a word like therefore, he's drawing some kind of a conclusion. The word therefore appears 19 times in the book of Hebrews to draw the reader's attention to the conclusions that can legitimately be drawn from the things that are being said. Now, the word appeared several more times in there as he quotes some Old Testament passages and other things. But 19 times, he's telling his readers that based on what they know and what is being said, therefore, as people have often said, that therefore is there for a reason. He's trying to get them to logically, reasonably see the points. On top of the therefores that's in the book of Hebrews, there's also a little expression that appears some 12 times in which the author says, let us go on, let us continue, let us leave behind, let us lay aside, 12 times. So it's not just logical, rational reasoning that's going on, there's practical application to our life being made. Based on these conclusions that are being laid out and the therefores, there are some let us passages that tells Christians what they need to be doing. And so that's also true in this middle section about Jesus, our great high priest. In Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, the writer, after having introduced the concept of Jesus as the high priest, he hasn't proven that yet. He just introduces the subject and now is going to prove that. In order to do that, the first thing he does is remind his own readers, who would know far better than we do, what a high priest was supposed to do. And so he says in Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, every high priest is selected from among men and is appointed to represent them in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. So he's reminding them of what a high priest is all about. He's appointed for the specific task of representing us before God, to make sacrifices for sin, and to offer gifts of worship on our behalf. Now he will show that Jesus does that in a far better way than the descendants of Aaron were ever able to do. So much is in these passages. I just want to briefly try to summarize this morning so next week we can move on to other aspects of the shadow of good things to come. But I want to just try to briefly present to you this morning four things the Hebrew writer tells us about Jesus that makes him the perfect high priest. What makes him so much better than the high priest they already had and had had all the way back to the days of Moses? Now, there's much more that could be said about this than what we'll say this morning, but we just sort of introduce you to the topic so you can appreciate the fact that we still have such a high priest today. And it's the very fact he is so perfect that we don't have to be under the fear and consternation that people in Jesus' day did. I mentioned a few weeks ago, I think, that there were actually Jewish people in Jesus' day and in the generations before him who had actually withdrawn from Jewish society and created private communities of their own because they had become convinced the high priest could no longer do his job and wasn't doing it. And therefore, if they continued to depend on him, they were not right with God. The Qumran community out by the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls have been found over the last half century or so, is the most noted of those communities, but not the only one. Those people, in some ways, wanted to trust and believe in their high priest in Jesus today, but at the same time, had to be fearful that perhaps what he was doing was not even acceptable to God because of his own failings, his own lack of real qualification anymore to serve in that role. But not so with Jesus. And so the Hebrew writer appeals to his audience to think about these things with him. And here's the first thing he says about Jesus that makes him so qualified. In chapter 4 of Hebrews, he says, starting in verse 14, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Jewish people were known for their, by the Romans, for their obstinance, for their stubbornness in refusing to give up their faith. They had such confidence in the sacrificial system that God had set up through Moses and the priest and the temple and all of that, they would die rather than give that up. The Romans often said, people who were that stubborn ought to be punished if for no other reason than they're so stubborn. They did. The Romans were a very practical kind of minded people in some ways. They didn't think anybody should believe in anything so much so they'd die for it when they could just change their mind and live. The writer tells Christians we can have that kind of confidence in Christ just like the Jews had in their old system. We can have more. Well, why? For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet was without sin. Here's the first reason Jesus is perfectly qualified as a high priest. He is able to sympathize with those he stands before the throne of God to represent. He knows what it's like to be tempted. He knows what it's like to suffer. He knows what it's like to endure. He knows what it's like to try to stand for right when wrong presses so hard against you. This is a strong statement by the Hebrew writer about the humanity of Jesus. You spend much time paying any attention to some of the shows that are on Discovery Channel or History Channel or others, they'll always be putting on some kind of show that tends to imply that whatever we believe about Jesus or about Christianity today isn't actually what they believed in the beginning. When I was in Bible college, one of our instructors introduced me to that Greek word called baloney. That's exactly what it is. It's foolishness. It's someone who's trying to mislead us about the truth. For history amply demonstrates that from the very beginning, Christians believed that Jesus was fully a man as well as completely divine. And because he was fully a man, he understood what it was like to suffer, to be tempted, to feel the pull of the wrong and the desires of the human part of him that would keep him from doing God's will. That's the same thing every high priest felt. The difference is, Jesus did not succumb to those temptations. And that stood out so starkly in the days when Jesus lived and when this book of Hebrews was being written because of the failings of the Jewish high priests that were in power during that period of time. Men who had succumbed to the temptation of power, and the temptation of wealth, and the temptation of lording it over those that they were actually supposed to be responsible for. Not so Jesus. Not so Jesus. And so the writer can say, because we have someone who is able to sympathize with us and fully understands, and some would even suggest maybe understands it even better than we do. For we are tempted and fail. He knows what it's like to be tempted and to have the strength to never fail. The temptation doesn't go away when you fail, but it sort of eases off because you've been broken by it. He was never broken by it. But because he understands what that is like and still represents us before God, it says, let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence. We can be confident as we come before God's throne. And he says, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. When we come before God's throne, we need mercy when we've sinned. And we need grace when we're trying to hold out and not sin. We need strength. And it says we can come to the throne of God with confidence to receive both of those things because the one sitting there on the throne with God knows exactly what we're dealing with and still will represent us before God. He doesn't look down upon us and say how puny, how weak, how sinful, how shameful, how unhappy he is with us. Just the opposite, the Hebrew writer says. He fully sympathizes and empathizes with us. This is the first thing that makes Jesus a perfect high priest for us. He even goes on, as we read in chapter 5, verse 1, that these high priests were all selected from among men and is appointed to represent them in matters relating to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. But then he goes back to this whole idea again of why he's so qualified on this idea of being sympathetic. He says, he is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and who are going astray. He says, Jesus even understands when we don't know enough to do right, when we're ignorant. And he understands even when we're being led astray. This is a great assurance that Christians are receiving about the high priest we have. Second reason why he's perfectly qualified to serve as a high priest is in chapter 5, starting in verse 4. No one takes this honor upon himself. He must be called by God, just as Aaron was. So Christ also did not take upon himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but God said to him, you are my son, today I have become your father. And then he says in another place, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So the second reason he's perfectly qualified is because God appointed his own son to be the high priest to represent us before him. Much has been made in times past, and I think rightly so, of the fact that not only does Jesus stand before God, the Son stands before the Father. And there's an empathy not only between Jesus and us, that is, he understands how we feel, but he also understands how the Father feels. But the empathy goes the other way too. The Father is connected in love and identity with the Son himself. Surely all of us know the difference between our own children asking us for something and the little boy or the little girl who lives next door asking us for something. It doesn't mean we're not understanding or sympathetic when they ask, but when it's our own child, how different it is. So Jesus is perfectly qualified to serve as our high priest because God appointed his own son to be a high priest on our behalf. And he established that appointment with an oath. The priests in the Old Testament took their positions by law. God appointed them to that by establishing a law. But with Jesus, he appointed him to that position by swearing an oath. And so he serves in that capacity, not as a descendant of Aaron, but in a sense as a descendant of another line of priest, the line of Melchizedek, which had nothing to do with who your father was or what your bloodline is, but it rather had to do with one who purely served because God appointed them and not because of who their father was. Except, of course, Jesus' father was God. And there's another thing that has to do with that as well. You know, even with Aaron himself serving as the first high priest in the days of Moses, Aaron struggled with sin. We have several instances in which Aaron failed to obey God's will. And that set the pattern, I guess you could say, for every high priest after him who always had to go in before God and offer sacrifice for sins for himself first. So then he could stand right with God. Then he could offer sacrifices for the sins of the people he's there to represent. But not so Jesus. He has been appointed by God as a priest who is obedient. If you've read here, you've heard these passages before in chapter 5 and verses 7 through 10 where it says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered, and once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Aaron was able to serve in his role as a high priest, even though he often failed and disobeyed God. He's the one that built the first golden calf. He's the one that stood along with his sister Miriam and criticized Moses for his leadership. He was a high priest characteristic of a whole line of high priests who themselves were sinners. But with Jesus, when he was called upon to obey God, though he suffered and there were tears, he obeyed. And ultimately we know that expression that came out in the garden that night before he's arrested. Nevertheless, Father, not my will, but yours be done. He's a perfect high priest because God appointed him on the basis of his perfect obedience to God while still being a man. And along with that is that he is a perfect high priest. The passage that David read to us as our sort of cornerstone verses for this lesson this morning, there in chapter 7 of Hebrews, such a high priest meets our need, verse 26, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. We have a sinless high priest. And the writer connects this sinlessness with his eternal life. We have a permanent sinless high priest. So this is the third reason why Jesus is perfect as a high priest for us. Not only is he sinless himself, but he lives forever. Those priests died one after the other and was replaced by the next one in line. Not so with Jesus. He was raised from the dead by the power of God and has ascended into the heavens. And so now he goes in and out before the very throne of God on our behalf forever. And so we can always be trusting that our sins are being taken care of because he always serves on our behalf as a perfect, eternal high priest. And then lastly, the writer tells us in chapter 8 of Hebrews that in order for Jesus to be high priest, the law had to be changed. Not just a law, the whole law. At first you might think, well, all God would have to do is just change the law that said that it has to be a descendant of Aaron. But no, the whole Old Testament system of sacrifice was built on that one law. And so if you're going to change that one law, you have to change everything. And Jesus is our perfect high priest because he is a priest of a new law, a new covenant that exists between man and God, a new relationship. And so the writer says, and of course we're just having to pick and choose a little bit of what it says here, but it says in Hebrews 8 and verse 6, but the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs, the old priest, as the covenant of which he is a mediator is superior to the old one. And it is founded on better promises. For if there had been nothing wrong with the first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God himself found fault with the people and said, the time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant and I turned away from them. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel. After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. The Hebrew writer points out the Old Testament prophecy that said that a time is coming when God was going to make a new covenant with his people. That implies that even God himself was not happy with the old covenant. It itself was not at fault. The people who were involved in the covenant with God were at fault. That's what made it imperfect. And once they were at fault, once their hearts wandered away from God, once they sinned and did not come back to him, that old covenant made no provision for permanent forgiveness of their sins. So God brings in a new covenant with a new high priest and a new sacrifice and a new access to the very throne of God. Not in a building made by hands on earth, but by the high priest himself going into heaven and standing before the very throne of God in heaven and offering the sacrifice of himself for the sins of the people. And everything changed. A shadow of good things to come. We have a hymn, one of the more modern hymns, I suppose. It's in our hymn book. It's only got one verse. I'll read the words to you. We place you on the highest place for you are the great high priest. We place you high above all else, and we come to you and worship at your feet. Hymn number 155. That's our high priest. As wonderful, as majestic, as impressive, as needed as the old high priest system was, it's been replaced with something far better. One priest forever. One sacrifice forever. A new covenant forever with God through Him. Next week, Lord willing, we'll start looking at some of the Jewish holidays that they celebrated and how those even pointed to what was to come. There's so much more to be said.